the pastor in residence program, part of the convocation program under the Division of Student Life, provides all of us with yet another opportunity for reflection and conversation regarding the office of the Holy Ministry. This year, we are privileged to have with us as our pastor in residence, the Reverend Jeffrey Myers. Pastor Myers is the Director of Pastoral Care and Family Life at Christ Lutheran Church in Lenexa, Kansas, a suburb of Kansas City, Kansas. His ministry involves the administration of pastoral care ministry going on there at Christ Lutheran, leading the Stephen ministry team, organizing workshops, lectures, and retreats, leading the strategic family ministry team in marriage and family life ministry, along with a considerable amount of teaching, lecturing, counseling, and networking with the community. Pastor Myers has also served the church at large in a number of ways throughout his pastoral ministry. Currently, he is a writer and presenter for Concordia Youth and Family Life Institute at Concordia, Ann Arbor, Michigan. Pastor Myers is a 1989 graduate of this seminary, having received his bachelor's from Concordia, Ann Arbor. He holds a Master of Arts in Counseling from Eastern Michigan University. He also holds professional memberships in the American Counseling Association, the American Mental Health Counselors Association, and the International Association of Marriage and Family Counselors. He's going to spend a few moments with us this morning talking about that which is near and dear to his heart, the ministry to and with married couples and families. Would you please join me in welcoming Pastor Myers?
Well, it all looks good on paper, doesn't it? Where was that? Here we go. I'm a close friend of Dr. Salmon, and if you don't hold that against me, he told me to tell you how, remind you how bright he is and smart and intelligent. You're laughing. When we talk about marriage and family ministry, the reason I bring up Brian's name, with all due respect, honestly, we've been working together now, and some of you have already heard this in classes and things, so I'll make it short, but our paths came back together after college, about 1990, and when Brian began working on his doctorate at St. Louis University, and I was in the area serving a parish in southern Illinois and Lutheran Child and Family Services. And as we began to talk, some of the ideas that you're going to hear today are outgrowth of that relationship between he and I as we continue to work. And then some of the solutions that I'll present that we're looking at are also an outgrowth and actually ministry and process, a cooperation between the two of us. And that's exciting to me, and I wanted to say that. While I do a lot of joking around with Pastor Salmon, and someone made the comment, can this man be serious for more than 30 seconds while I was over there? Sometimes he can be, if you get him at those special moments in life. But I respect his thinking and his the way that he reads so much, it's hard to even keep up with him in these areas, but it's great to be working with him. Okay, all that being said, by the way, I like to start out with these little things. This was passed to me. It came off the internet. The internet's a wonderful place for some things, for jokes and stuff. And this is a pastor thing. A pastor of one church who was previously a sailor was very aware that ships are addressed as she and her. Now, we're going to talk about marriage and family here. So he often wondered what gender computers should be addressed as. Should they be she or he? So to answer the question, he set up two groups of computer experts. The first was comprised of women, the second of men. Each group was asked to recommend whether computers should be referred to in the feminine gender or the masculine gender. They were asked to give four reasons for their recommendation. The first group, the group of women, reported that computers should be referred to in the masculine gender, and here are their reasons. One, in order to get their attention, you have to turn them on. Two, they have a lot of data but are still clueless. Three, They are supposed to help you solve problems, but half the time they are the problem. Four, I'm glad you guys can laugh at yourselves. Four, as soon as you commit to one, you realize that if you had waited a little longer, you could have had a better model. All right. The men, on the other hand, concluded computers should be referred to in the feminine gender. And here are their reasons. No one but the Creator understands their internal logic. Amen? We can almost be Baptist with that one. Two, the native language they use to communicate with other computers is incomprehensible to everyone else. It's true. Three, even your smallest mistakes are stored in long-term memory for later achievement. Boy, oh boy, you guys have been there, huh? Four, as soon as you commit to one, you find yourself spending half your paycheck on accessories for it. You can thank my daughter for that little ditty. She pulled it off the internet for me. We keep track of that, though. What I'd like to talk about a little bit is deal with some of the data, first of all, of what's going on out there. What are the family, the condition of the families and the marriages as you enter into the parish? What are we seeing in the field across the country? I'd like to present, I think, and clarify the picture somewhat for you with some data that we've collected over the last couple years that I think will help with that. And then finally, after we do that, what are the results of that data? What has occurred? And then finally, what are some of the solutions? How do we deal with it? How can we, as pastors and churches, work with our marriages and families with divorces and living together in other situations like that? And I'm going to do all of that in 40 minutes, so it will be another miracle to record. I'll do my best to get through that, and then I'll answer questions at about 11 o'clock. I'll keep a little bit of tabs on time. If I go too far, just someone kind of cough real loud, or there might be a trap door here. This is kind of a... I look for the thing to... Anyway. Let me start out with saying that a couple thoughts come to mind. First of all, marriage is, especially if you look in the confessions, and we've been reaching back and studying through that, and through back to Genesis, is a primary institution of God, a blessed estate that God wants to protect and wants to honor as amongst us as human beings. One of His universal blessings to the world at large. And in saying that, though, as I present, I don't want to give I don't want to give one false impression. That is, I don't want to give the impression to anybody that by being in a good or solid marriage or by being chaste and a virgin going into that marriage, that somehow you earn God's grace. I think that's something we need to be upfront with, very clear right out of the start. That has nothing to do with that. On the other hand, saying that, I want to make also clear that the God of grace in Jesus Christ is also a God of order. And His plan, His order for this, for people riveted to planet Earth works. And it works well. The blueprint is there for us to follow as His people. So there's a lot more we could go into about that, but just saying that, I want to then dive in. Where are we at? What happens when that couple comes into the pastor's office? Well, let me tell you about the average couple. That would be the couple walks in, there's a 50-50 bet that this is what you will face. That couple, at least one of them will have already been married at least one time. Probably there will be kids involved, at least one child. That couple at some point during their period of engagement will live together. If they haven't or aren't living together, at some point before they're married, 90% of these couples will be sexually active. Now, if that doesn't kind of make you wonder about what you're doing going into the ministry and having to deal with marriages, one of those practical sides, one of the first things you'll walk into, then the interesting thing is, on top of that, is you'll probably be the last person to know that they're getting married. They've made all the plans, they've made all the arrangements, they've got the reception hall all taken care of, and they're willing to dish out, on average, about $19,000 for this wedding to occur across the country. Lest you think that your fee, or well, maybe not a fee, your honorarium is too low, it probably is, but don't worry about that. You're doing this as a service anyways. But $19,000, think about that. Maybe your wedding, mine wasn't anywhere near that. But after I thought about it and I went and done a few of those, I can see where it easily adds up. Now, this average couple that I just painted a picture for, if they go into the average church, or not even that, if they go into 4 out of 5 of our churches across the country, that would be Protestant churches, or and in this some of these studies were lumped with Protestants. I know there's always that debate, I guess. But 4 out of 5 churches are doing nothing for this couple. They're just going to marry them. And if that's done, left unprepared, this couple will be divorced within 5 years. Now, where does he get all these brilliant things? Actually, as you know, and it's not a secret, divorces have tripled between 1960 and 1980. And up to today, actually, the divorce rate has declined a little bit, about 1.6% since 1980. We have approximately a little over 1 million divorces a year in this country. We perform a little over 2 million marriages. Now, most people say, well, here's the statistical problem. You divide the marriages by divorce rate, by number of divorces, and you get the divorce rate. There's a problem with that. It's not statistically viable, yada, yada, yada. Divorce isn't that big of an issue. Hold the phone. Actually, it is a huge issue. Approximately 2% of the population divorces each year. Now, add to this, if the people that do this kind of research, well, you start with Barna's statistics, but he's not always, you gotta be careful with this because I don't know him personally or anything. His stuff isn't it doesn't tend to be as accurate as others. He says it's about a 25% chance of the first married couple getting a divorce. National Institute of Health statistics puts that figure at about 43%. But by far the best study done, it comes out of the University of Wisconsin National Survey of Family and Households. Their sample population was 13,000. And what they found in that is that actually 60% of marriages are currently failing. By that they mean the divorce rate, they put it at about 50%, with 10% of marriages in the process of failing. Now, no matter how you cut this pie up, there's a huge problem. There's a huge problem out in our congregations. And it gets worse with subsequent marriages. You would think that after a couple went through this one time, or a person went through it once, they would learn their lesson, and that the second and third marriages would be stronger, better. But in fact, 2/3 of those marriages fail. 2/3. 2 out of 3 subsequent marriages fail. And they increase 5% when there are children involved. And these relationships, these marriages fail 2 years sooner on average than the rest of the population. The number of divorced people in our country has soared. In 1970, just after the Beatles broke up, for those that are counting, 4 million, there were 4 million divorced unmarried people in our country. Just an aside on divorce, as I talk about this, it just popped into my mind. I wanted to make sure I said, this is not a time I want to dump on people that are divorced. As a pastor, one of the most neglected population is the divorced population. That when someone loses a spouse or a child or a parent dies, usually the care for that person is pretty thorough. People come around them, they share a meal, they support them, people follow up. But when a divorce happens, as they've studied folks that have gone through that, it seems that the church basically abandons, a church across America, a Christian church, abandons these folks. and it puts them into a stigmatized category. And, well, of course, what that does is that means the last thing you want to be called is a divorced person, and it hustles and hastens them rushes them back into a married life. And I think, personally, I think that's part of the problem, that higher statistic for remarriages. Instead of slowing them down and saying, wait a minute, you don't make the same mistake. We'll come around you, we'll support you, we'll help you recover from that, which has occurred. And of course, there's other issues involved with divorce than just that. But I think that that's an important group to keep an eye on. As Dr. Jim Talley says in one of his books, 80% of divorces end in marriage. So, you know, take that for what it's worth. At this time, there are currently 18 million, up from 4 million in 1970 to 1996, there are 18 million divorced unmarried people. For most men, divorce ends in remarriage. But this is not true for women, and it is especially not true for women with children. Now, one of the things that few people realize in all this data is that while the marriage rate has plunged, let me back up. Few people realize that the marriage rate, in fact, has plunged 41% since 1960. What does that mean? That means that there are the rate, and they're measuring it through women, the rate of people choosing to get married has dropped significantly. There are fewer people today choosing, for the population, choosing to marry, about a 41% plunge overall. You know, some people are delaying it, waiting till they're older, age-wise. But probably the biggest contributor to that plunge has been cohabitation. It's become a substitute for millions of Americans for marriage. In fact, cohabitation, the cohabiting of couples, has soared over tenfold over the since 1960 to 1996. It's dismal. You can't believe when you start looking at this data how, frightening it is. In 1960, about 430,000 couples were cohabiting. That is in March of 1960. Now, cohabiting is a tough one to measure because these relationships, on average, only last 18 months. And that includes the ones that choose to marry. So there's a lot of turnover in that data. So it's a little tough to get a firm figure, but say 430,000 as of March in 1960. As of March 1996, 4 million were choosing to cohabit each year. Now, if you add to that turnover rate, even at 50%, we're probably looking at about 6 million couples who shack up a year, compared to 2.3 million marriages. So that means even if we're conservative, and most of us are, then there's four, you caught that, someone likes it, right? He's gonna hustle home and listen to Rush Limbaugh. Just kidding, don't base a whole lot on that. 4 million, even if you do a conservative data, you're still having twice as many couples choosing to live together each year than marry. Checking the time. Now, if I could turn this over and start looking at the results of this within our country. America has the worst record of broken marriages in the world. It's pathetic. Results of divorce. Lest you think that, well, so what, Pastor? You know, it happens, that's where our country's at, what can we do about it? Well, there are some disastrous results of this. Less than 10% of divorces, even 10 years later, do both husband and wife, construct happier, fulfilling lives, according to Judith Wallerstein. And some people debate her data. I suppose you can, but there's other people with studies similar to that. There's a book called Generation at Risk that pulls together a lot of this data, even outside of Judith Wallerstein's, that corroborates a lot of what she's found. That's kind of scary when you think about it. And what's the result of cohabiting? What's the result of cohabiting? Back to that study from the University of Wisconsin, it proved that cohabitation is a double cancer of marriage. See, those who shack up are 50% more likely to divorce than those who never lived together, according to this study. So you have a divorce rate that goes from 50% up to 75% from first married people. Of 100 couples who cohabit, 60 will marry. Instead of 30 divorcing, 45 of those couples, that 60, will divorce, leaving only 15 couples still together after 10 years. And 40 cohabitants will break up short of marriage. Now, it may not seem like a tragedy, but what they've done is they've cashed in a whole lot of what the glue that it takes to sustain a marriage by cohabiting, by putting, people that live together, and this is a bit of an observation, and I think we could prove this back up by study, they tend to lose a sense of right and wrong. They tend to cash that in. What do I mean by that? Well, I brought a piece along that I've done now for a couple years in our parish called Living Together. I try to work with the couples that are living together. I don't just come right out and say, I'm not going to marry you. I slow them down and I want to interact with them. I want to know their reasons why and slowly tighten the screws down until they see things the way they need to, what they're doing to themselves, to their relationship to God, and to their future marriage. And here's the answer. This is basically 20 reasons why not to live together. No Bible verses in it. It's just data, just for them to read. And here's some of the responses I get. One of my questions is, what do you think would happen if you moved into separate residences and chose to be sexually chaste until you were ready to marry each other? Yeah, what would happen? You know, give me a worst case. This guy says, I would go crazy. I think we would be fine living at separate residences because we've done it in the past, although the chaste part would not work for me. You know, I think he's afraid something's going to fall off if he were chaste. Here's what the young lady responded in this survey that I had, and here's her question was, considering the conclusive and overwhelming data in the Living Together article, why would you not move into separate households? Well, she says, the statistical data in these articles seems to reflect people in general rather than Christians with the conviction that divorce is wrong. Now, you're laughing. But now you get a glimpse of the world you're stepping into. Do you see the way these folks can live with this moral ambiguity? They're going to want to go to church and think that it's fine that they're living together and not see anything wrong with it. And they're going to become offended if you challenge them. And all of a sudden it's going to be the church's fault and your fault. And so it's something we have to wrestle with. What I'm getting at here is they lose their sense of right and wrong and how to make a relationship work. It's not just that it's a moral wrong that needs to be worked out with in terms of the relationship to God, but it's also a wrong on the horizontal plane of existence. It damages their chances of success in marriage, and it undermines their ability to have a fulfilling life, a fulfilling marriage. You know, I still think sometimes we get wrong-headed with some of the commandments as believers, that it's not just that God wants to make our life miserable by giving us a bunch of rules to follow. But what he wants to do is make even our lives here on earth blessed. And that these blueprints that he has for us in terms of married life work. They work. And that's why it's important to follow them. I think that sexuality before marriage inappropriately and superficially bonds couples together. Inappropriate and superficial bond. True intimacy can only be, listen to me real carefully, true intimacy can only be, and I have a license to say this, true intimacy can only be achieved through good, solid communication skills, solid conflict resolution skills that build a closeness and a strong friendship between a couple. and when sexuality is saved, for the security, the importance of safety and security within a marriage. That's laying it on the line. I guess I can't say it any clearer than that. Now, one of the surprising consequences of widespread cohabitation is, as I said before, is that a number of couples are choosing not to marry at all. The number of never married people has soared from 21 million in 1970 to 45 million in 1996. Again, I'm just presenting data here. This isn't a study or anything. These are just raw figures. This is not something that you can argue with. It wasn't as if it were a study in that sense. These are not happier couples. These are not happier people. In fact, these are people that have, when they've delayed in this way, and for those reasons, are more likely to abuse alcohol, to report being lonely, and to have promiscuous lifestyles, and are at huge risk of contracting sexually transmitted diseases, a silent taboo within our country and within our churches that no one really wants to talk about, where some college campuses are 1 in 3 students have a sexually transmitted disease. It's a huge epidemic and a big problem. And this is one of the main drivers of that problem, that issue. In saying that, what I find with my single adults, even some of the ones I respect the most within my congregation, they'll come to me, they're all broken up inside, you know, I was going out with so-and-so, and they're maybe in their early 30s, and we were dating and stuff like that, and she broke up, and I just can't get over it. I'm hurting so bad, and I can understand that. I want to talk about that. But then when I say, well, are you sexually active? Well, yeah, sure we did. In fact, you know, I spent last weekend with her. But what does that have to do with anything? And here's somebody that's active in the congregation, and you just find this information out. That's the kind of thing that you're going to have to deal with. You know, you talk about law gospel ministry becoming practical. This is where the rubber hits the road. So you've got to deal with those kinds of ambiguities that they present to you, and it's causing all sorts of damage and problems in their spiritual life, in their physical life, and in their mental life. They bought a lie. They've bought a lie. When's the last time any TV, movie, anything that you've seen come out of Hollywood represent a healthy home? Well, this last Robin Williams flick where heaven is just this, you know, happy Monet painting, interesting little twist on what hell is too. Anyway, if you haven't seen it, I'm not going to go any further. You can go watch it if you want to. Wait for the video. It's not that good. And what has happened, here's the biggest tragedy of all as far as I'm concerned. Out of wedlock births have soared. And this is another huge issue you'll be walking into, stepping into, because these are the kids that are going to be coming into your confirmation class. And they're going to be carrying a truckload of baggage by the time they come to see you. A number of these kids that have gone through one divorce, 45% of the kids that have gone through one divorce, let me see if I got this right, 45% of the kids that have gone through one divorce before age 8 will go through 2 by the age 18. Don't think for a minute that that's not damaging them emotionally, their ability to form lasting relationships. Here's the kicker with in George Gallup's stuff. Again, he talks about that 80%, if you go out to the Gen X, whatever, 30 and under, that's probably a whole lot of, I see some of you are 30 and under, some of you can't raise your hand, I know that. He's saying that 80% of those folks want to have a lifelong marriage. That's what they stand for. Yet this is a generation that has some of the worst relationship building skills of any we've had to this point, because they've lived through damaged marriages. On top of that, they see that their solution is you divorce, you get conflict, you leave. And on top of that, with the evangelical divorce rate is 17% of the population, while they represent only 12% of the population in terms of numbers. So that means that in some ways Christians are divorcing faster than the rest of the population. Imagine that. Now, what that means is that here's this youngster who's watched mom and dad go to church and then try to go there for some solutions and things like that, and they still end up getting divorced, and they don't see, in terms of modeling, of course there's more to the picture than just modeling. We're dealing with the gifts of God here, so I think you need to be a little careful with this. But in terms of modeling, they're seeing that the church is not a place that holds marriages together and can, in some instances, be cooperative with the pain and destruction in their lives. Out-of-wedlock births have increased sixfold since 1960, another consequence of widespread cohabitation. Because what happens when you have sex? Gee, you put tab A in slot B, you get a baby. How about that? Think of this, you know, just imagine that. That's what happens, you know? The power of creation out of that. And what's come out of this is that 40% of cohabiting couples have children born out of wedlock. Now, what do you think the odds are of them ever seeing their father when that relationship breaks down within 18 months? Not very good. Not very good at all. Children pay the highest price. In the book Generation at Risk, the authors that comes out of Penn State University and the University of Nebraska, so they do something besides playing football. Come on, it's a little bit. They have a good football team, though. I think half of Nebraska moves to Kansas City for to work, because we sure have a lot of folks, wonderful folks from Nebraska, by the way. In that book, A Generation at Risk, what he's saying is that there are two categories of damaged children, or they say. The severely conflicted couple, does that damage children? Yes, it does. Don't kid yourself about that either. But that damage is different from the damage that divorce causes the kids as well, and I'll get into that damage in just a second. What they talk about happening in our country over the last, since 1960, maybe 1970, is a lowering of the threshold of divorce. No one's challenging them. No one's saying, don't do it. And they divorce for more simple and easy reasons. And what they found in their study, according to what happens to the children, they say, and this is fascinating, of course this isn't focused on the family or anything like that. This isn't a bastion of family research council or anything. These are public secular universities, and what they're finding is that 70% of divorces should not occur for the sake of the children. It would be better for the parents to endure on behalf of their kids. What a turnaround that is from what we were hearing even 20 years ago. So, that's what they're reporting. And what that puts back into our lap, of course, is the difficult task of challenging those couples that come to us and say, well, Pastor, that's it, we're done. Hold the phone. Wait a minute. What happens to these kids? Because they're the ones that are going to be the most damaged. Dropout rates double. Children of divorce or cohabitation are twice as likely to drop out of school than children of intact married families. And that's by five different studies. Two of them are national survey studies. Two of them are from different bureaus of the federal government. And one independent study on top of that corroborates that evidence. They have twice the rate of dropout. Children living without fathers is a huge problem in our country as well. Let me paint this picture very clearly for you. Largely as a result of divorce, 40% of America's children live in homes where their natural father does not live. The numbers soared from 6 million to 24 million from 1960 to 1990, living without their fathers. Never, at least this is reported by one writer, this is reported by Mike McManus, he concludes that never before in the history of the world has there been such an abandonment of children by their fathers. I would add a deliberate abandonment, of course, you know, through war and things like that and plague and stuff. When a father dies prematurely, that's one thing. But this is a deliberate abandonment of children across our country. 24 million, and the projections are that'll reach 40 million. Now, you want a prescription for violence, you just heard it. And as you go into inner cities, and you see within our black community a 63% single parent rate, that there's 63% of the households are single parents. Our rate within our, meaning I'm white, is that it's approaching 50%. That's another issue you're going to walk into when you walk into the parish. Now, so as those things have soared, there's a direct impact on poverty. I'm going to limit my comments so we can get to the questions. Poverty is a direct result of this. Child of white parents has only 3.6% chance of living in poverty in this country if the child's living with both mother and father. But that soars to 12.6%, four times as many are in poverty if the child's being raised in a single-parent home. And among blacks, the number more than doubles from 19% to 49%. The root cause of poverty, dropout rate, lack of education. There are other correlations with that. I didn't bring all that data, so I won't say that. The other thing that's interesting is that what we're seeing with people that have gone through divorces, women's probability of survival after divorce sharply decreases. People who stay married live longer than those who are single or divorced. And our evidence is starting to show this out. A woman who divorces at age 48, only 66% will live to 65. But 87% of those who remain married are alive at age 65. A woman who divorces is 2 to 3 times as likely to contract all types of cancer. You know, and this is, and it's the same for men, same data for men. It just goes back to the original design. It's not good for these people to be alone. I think a number of things are part of this puzzle. I think the stress increases dramatically. If even that person chooses to remarry, the relationships they're stepping into are automatically, right off the bat, more conflicted. There's a geometric increase of the number of lines of relationships that need to be maintained. And should they choose not to, there's a dramatic increase in loneliness, and that's what's reported as well. So those are just some of the results, and there are more that could be added. Now, how does the church fit into this picture as a whole, across the nation? 75% of American churches, or 75% of Americans marry in a church. 69%, these are Gallup studies, 69% are members of a church or synagogue, and 43% across our country attend church or synagogue weekly. Yet, 50% of all new marriages fail. There's a problem. When I heard Mike McManus speak, he said, well, we become wedding factories, blessing machines. And Dr. Scott Brusick, when he talked on this topic, said we've become ecclesiastical vending machines. How about that one, huh? Boy, it's kind of scary to sit in the face of that kind of accusation, but you got to wonder, when you have this kind of a captive audience, as we do with a couple that's getting married, if they've laid out $15,000, folks, and they're finally coming to you, you know what? They're going to do a whole lot of things that you ask them to do in order to get married. You have a captive audience. Do not be afraid of them. It's okay to have some rigorous standards as they get married. It's not a crime, and it is often very, very helpful for them. In France and Germany, this is pathetic. France and Germany, only 10% of people attend church weekly, yet only 25% of their marriages fail. Half of that of the U.S. Yeah. Gee. We have great access to the American public, but I don't see that that's being used wisely in working with these couples. And these are the reasons why I see most churches, why this happens. First of all, I don't see that there's usually very much help for seriously dating couples, that large population of singles, to help them decide whether or not to get married or if that's the right person to help shape some of those values, to come alongside of them. Engaged couples are not helped to build lifelong marriages. They're not taught how to do that. For example, they're not trained how to resolve conflict many times. Many do so destructively, just do it on the fly and don't have the skills, and it's going to be an increasing problem. Few churches have any broken engagements as a result of their premarital counseling. You know, if I don't get 10% of my couples that break up as a result of premarital counseling, I'm upset. You can't tell me that all the couples come should be married. Now, I don't know who they are, and I don't tell them that they shouldn't necessarily. I want them to make those decisions. And, you know, it's just a simple thing. An inventory, whether you use Focus or you use Prepare Enrich, just by giving an inventory without even scoring it, just by handing it to them and having them go through it, 10% of those couples will choose not to marry. You just lower the divorce rate in your parish. Simple thing to do. That's just one strategy. Let me see. And the other thing is getting past just innocuous questions while you're helping them prepare for marriage. Half of newlyweds are horrified by their conflicts. They don't even want to talk about it. Women who are much wiser usually about relationships than men, they're usually the ones that first see the problems but didn't dare to discuss them out of fear for rocking the boat. Rock the boat, guys. Rock the boat. Sometimes I see myself as a dentist. I'm going to poke around until something hurts. A little bit. Not, you know, I'm not that. I sound tough up here, but I'm not nearly that tough when I'm with the couple. I am a sensitive person. I'm a counselor, so you know how that works. The guys, most of them are oblivious to problems. Kind of what I was started off with. But on the honeymoon and shortly afterwards, man, the trouble hits. And living together doesn't work as a trial marriage. Marriage is one shoe you can't try on before you buy it. Most churches have no strategy. I've said that before. There's no plan in most churches to save troubled marriages. When is the last time you saw a church have any kind of inkling or plan on how to save a troubled marriage? What do? You send them to the Christian counselor, right? You know, we'll help you pay for it. We'll give you $500 and $50 an hour and send you to the Christian counselor. Well, guess what? Diane Soley, with the American Association of Marriage and Family Therapy, she states this, that in her study, she shows that only 20% of marriages are saved that seek help from a counselor. Whereas, and here's a reason, that the counselors and therapists tend to look at marriage as a disease to be diagnosed and not a relationship whose communication and conflict resolution skills need work. There's no plan in most churches on how to help separated to reconcile or step families to survive and make it. Those are the kinds of things that happen that aren't put in place. Now, quite simply, these are the things, and I'm going to end at this. Someone's watch went off. Thank you. You know, these cell phone things and stuff. I had a cell phone go off in church on me once. You know, you just want to stop everything. You're right in the middle of your sermon, you want to say, time out, walk up to the person, grab their phone, and just kind of, you know, throw it out and back somewhere. Say, thank you, okay, we're going to go on now. You know, no one is that important. Let me give you a couple things that are very simple, and the reason I can just rattle them off, and you can use them, and they will work. You can help avoid bad marriages before they begin. Like I said, simple thing, like using an inventory. That doesn't take a whole lot. One of the things that Dr. Solomon and I are working on are creating mentor couples in congregations, using the lay people. Those couples that have been married for 30 years or more successfully have a wealth of knowledge. They could be trained in these simple instruments and to deliver them to couples. It's not a hard brain surgery procedure. It can work. Give marriage insurance to the engaged by using surveys like that. Use Engage Encounter. Call the local Catholic church. You know, warn your people a little bit about the family planning things they do. But, you know, they're going to talk about the relationship. It's going to be a private time. They're not going to turn Catholic by going on an Engage Encounter if you prepare them right. Use some of those things in your community like that. They work. Strengthen existing marriages. There are Lutheran marriage encounters. People that go on that, nearly 90% of the people that go on Marriage Encounter come back saying, we've fallen back in love. We've fallen back in love. And it tends to have lasting results. There are other things, family life conferences and marriage enrichment. There's a whole host of things out there right now. You can use them. Some of them you got to keep an eye on and prepare your couples for. We use a couples retreat in our church. Even 80 to 90% of the most troubled marriages can be saved. In Kansas City and across 100 different communities in this country, there's a program called RetroVi. RetroVi was started as an alternative to marriage enrichment or marriage encounter by those couples that didn't do well with it. You know, and what they did is they took couples that their relationship were near the brink of breaking up and they brought it back. And these are the couples that lead a RetroVi weekend. And what happens is when you send a couple that's even divorced, they commit to going to a RetroVi weekend, 80% success rate. Now, think of this. Counseling's 20%, RetroVi's 80%. Which one do you think you want them to go on? And they come back, the couples that I have that come back from RetroVi are saying things like, you know, well, first of all, I notice their commitment to the congregation soars. RetroVi is Christian-based. They don't carry a Catholic banner into it. Don't you hate this? I mean, doesn't this drive you crazy? I have to keep mentioning the Catholic Church because they're doing things that are head and shoulders above what most churches are doing. Gosh, that drives me nuts. Anyway, 80% of them are saved by going on that kind of a weekend. And that, again, is not hard for you to do as a pastor with time. You have that, you hand it, they call it, they go. Yeah? It doesn't take much. You follow them up as their spiritual leader. These couples come back saying, you know, we realize that love is a decision. And I decided every day to be in love with my wife and in my marriage. These are the kinds of things they're coming back and saying to me. We communicate in a whole different way than we did before. That's the stuff they're saying to me. And I resonate to that. And finally, the other thing that we're doing is, I mentioned being involved in the community. We do a community marriage statement. We have 40 churches around our church that have come together, basically pooled their marriage standards, four-month preparation, waiting period, and there's a list of things, and pooled the resources and signed it. And the newspaper eats that up. And they're there, and they like it. It's a community effort and stuff. And it's a natural place for churches to cooperate outside of worship and other things like that that cause so much grief and trouble. So that's been a nice piece that's worked real well for us as well to raise attention. In fact, after we signed that, with our mentor couples, we prepared about 10 marriages that I'd performed in our church last year, but we had over 30 couples prepared for marriage that I didn't touch that came in from the community. So what that means is that two-thirds of the marriages that were prepared for by our church last year were for couples that were not members of our church, at least when they went into it. That's a great opportunity for us, at least it has been. I'm going to end at this point, and I guess that is right. About 10 minutes or so for questions.
You spoke to us yesterday about some of the ideas you had. I'm just wondering, what are the results? How long have you been trying these new techniques, and how is the rate of divorce in your parish gone down?
It's a little preliminary to say, so I wouldn't want to venture out. What we're doing is, what Dr. Solomon and I have set up is a pre-test, post-test situation so that when a couple enters in, they take an inventory when they start the process, and then when they exit a year and a half after the marriage, so you're looking at about 2 years, they take it once again, they take the married version of it. And we're hoping to measure a couple different things. First of all, you know, are the marriages lasting? The seeds of most divorce occur in the first year of marriage. So we want to measure and see, are their skills growing? Are they learning? Has this helped any? And then also count the number of divorces. So I'm, you know, ask this question about 10 years from now, 5 years from now, and we ought to have better answers for you. It appears that it should work, but you know how that is.
A lot of pastors that I've talked to, they mention that when they do marriage counseling, that the couple comes to them way too late in the process, that they've already made their minds for divorce. What are some ways that churches can encourage couples to come earlier in the process of trying to fix the marriage?
Well, I hate to say just to, you know, put it in the sermon type of an answer. You know, I think you can focus on that. I think it's a lot on how you set up the tone within a congregation, if it comes across as that this is a place that, you know, you don't have problems, and, you know, for heaven's sakes, make sure, you know, everything's pressed and looks good and don't admit to anything, you're going to have trouble with that. And that's not a theological issue so much as a culture within the within a given congregation. So one of the ways is to, you know, weave them into messages where it's appropriate. Make sure you're up front with that. For example, we did one, and I mentioned this before, and I don't know why I did this. It doesn't happen much. Usually I follow my outline and do what I do, but I, Living Together was weaved into this, and I got to that point, and I stepped up and I said, look, you know, if you're living together, don't give me the economic excuse. That's a poor excuse. Quit living together like a pair of dogs in heat and split up. So I got done afterwards, and a senior pastor came up to me and said, well, what on earth was that all about? What did you do? I don't know, I said. I just, you know, Holy Spirit or something. And you guys liked it. And the thing that happened, though, and I'm not saying this is just a thing that came out of it. It wouldn't happen every time. But there was a couple at that service that was living together, unbeknownst to us. And they were visiting. And the long and short of it is, they called me up the next week and said, you cut me to the quick. You know, this is painful what you said. Could we meet with you? And so we talked. They split up, and they got married last September, about a year after they heard that message. And so, you know, it's not something you have to be afraid of. It depends a lot. What we are very careful to do, though, is we make sure that we support our couples. We surround them. We don't abandon people. Don't abandon people. So that if you're going to make a hard message, don't abandon the people. Don't just turn them loose. But stay behind them. Help them work through sometimes a very difficult moral decision in their minds.
Just a first-year student, what can I be doing in preparation for when I become a pastor? What kind of classes or what kind of training can I be getting? I don't envision myself going and getting a master's in counseling.
Right, and I wouldn't say that's for everybody, as you can see. Although, you know, in a little bit of that, there is a shortage, I would say. I get numerous phone calls from parishes and churches that say, is there anybody else out there? And we want a pastor, but we also want them to have that kind of marriage and family therapy background. If you have an interest in that, there's a wealth of good schools, and that would be worth pursuing because that's just a rare bird. Usually you get someone that's often left field and clinical, you know, chasing around homosexual relationships, or you get someone off over here, you know, that is just lost and not sure how to make a difference. And to find those people that can bridge that kind of a gap is important. What you can do is real simple. I know that Brian, I'd be a little careful with this, I don't want to toot my own horn, but the last couple of years we've been coming in and teaching Prepare and Rich, giving that training. I think that's real important to have that under your belt. I would wait till fourth year, though, before I would do that, because you want to, as soon after you take it, you want to be able to use it. That would be just a very simple way to walk into a parish with that. I know Dr. Solomon addresses a whole lot of these issues, especially the casuistry issues in his classes. I guess you take that second year now as well, right, pastor's counselor? I don't know if that's good or bad. I wouldn't presume to second-guess those who made those decisions. So, you know, I know he deals with a number of those issues in his classes. And the bigger thing is I think when you first step into the parish, one of the couple things I did is getting to know my people right away. But the second thing was also getting to know the community. I visited with other pastors. I got in touch with the family life, the Catholic Church. The family life people in the Catholic Church, I guess, are the lowest rung of the hierarchy. So they're, you know, they're always ready to talk to you. I'm not picking on, but that I find the agencies and the things like that and meet with the people, the counselors and folks like that, you know, just set up a schedule over about 6 months or so, and I learn from them. What's going on in the community? What's happening? You know, if I have a troubled marriage, what are you going to do? What can happen with that? Where's the retrovi meet? When does it meet? Would a couple be willing to come in and talk to a group of people within my church? We had a retrovi couple in that were just wonderful. And then a couple of mine went on a weekend, and it literally saved their marriage. And now they go to other Lutheran churches and will, you know, give a spiel to a Bible study or something like that and talk to them a little bit about what it's about. Take away some of the fear and stigma, back to your question was. So those are some of the things that I would recommend that can happen right away. And don't be afraid to jump in and make a difference. And they don't take a whole lot of time to do those things, because a lot of you, there's a lot of work. When I present this stuff to pastors, sometimes they just say, hey, it's all good, but, you know, you know, that's going to happen at about hour 60 for my week this week. So I'm trying to be sensitive to that as well.
Thank you very much, Pastor.
Thank you.